Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll talk with Robert Frodeman, one of the editors of the new book, A Watershed Moment, The American West in the Age of Limits. The American West is often portrayed as a place of rugged, unending landscapes, presenting us with boundless opportunities. But the land is more fragile and resources more finite than popular perceptions acknowledge. This collection of essays reveals tensions between a culture of economic growth and personal freedom and the ecological, economic, and social constraints set by community values and the land itself. Robert Frodeman is a retired professor of philosophy who writes on environmental philosophy and public policy, philosophy of science, technology, and the future of the university. A founding director of the Center for the Study of Interdisciplinarity at the University of North Texas, he is author, editor of 16 books, and has lectured at and consulted for universities and science agencies worldwide. Before we welcome him in, a couple of events to mention. Robert Frodeman will be on a panel at the Wallace Stegner Center, a Green Bag event, on Thursday, November 21st, starting at 12:15 at the University of Utah College of Law. It's also be available virtually. You can register for that. And then the next day, Friday, November 22nd, again, a panel discussion and refreshments, music, and art at Westminster University in Salt Lake City. That's starting at 5:30 on Friday, November 22nd. So, Robert Frodeman, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So, Watershed Moment, this is, you got a bunch of contributors here, a various variety of authors. The subtitle, The American West in the Age of Limits. What was your goal with this volume?
We're hoping to shift the conversation that we're having across the Intermountain West. There's lots of conversations going on, of course, but we have a sense that there's two points driving this volume. First, that communities across the Intermountain West can learn from one another, from both their successes and failures in dealing with the problems of drought and wildfire and housing and whatnot. But second, we're interested in framing this in terms of what we think will be an imminent shift in culture from a culture that assumes and presupposes abundance of space and resources and opportunity to one which is largely defined by limits set by the land itself, but also by the limits of community values.
I want to jump in a little bit to your introduction. Very fascinating. You get into some of these issues. You talk about how during Jefferson's time, I don't know if Jefferson said this, but I think it was him, that he felt, and I think people agreed with him, that there was enough land and space in America to accommodate the thousandth generation, right? And you're right, it took four generations to fill up America.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. You can begin the story with a philosopher, an English philosopher named John Locke, Locke is the founding father of our founding fathers. That's to say, his political philosophy guided our own founding fathers in the writing of the Constitution. And Locke said in 1692, the whole world is America. And what he meant by that was that all the bounds of European culture were now taken off because we have this seemingly endless expanse of land and resources. And from the point of view of the technology of his day or of Jefferson's day, it was an effective infinity. And so you cite Jefferson's comment from his inaugural address. He thought the American West, and he didn't even mean all of the American West, he meant the Louisiana Purchase area, would take 1,000 generations to fill up. What he did not anticipate was the railroad and telegraph and this tremendous explosion of technology which meant that by 1890, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, the frontier had ended.
And you write that at that point, the frontier became central to the nation's view of itself, right? The myths, important myths that that we have had.
Yeah, well, this is such an attractive story, right? That we had this endless, it took all the bounds off of our behavior. And so what happened post-Civil War was this, as the land began to fill up in the West, is that this ideology moved from the practical to the mythological. And so what you see in the 1870s and the 1880s, and then supercharged by Hollywood beginning in the 1900s, was this myth of the cowboy, right? This lone individual who strikes out on his own, who defies convention, you know, who settles problems with a gun, right? This myth was a kind of nostalgia for a lost past, a lost pastoral past as America industrialized and urbanized. And so part of the story we tell in this book is this cowboy myth in all its permutations. So for instance, if you look at, you know, folks who think back to Humphrey Bogart and Maltese Falcon or The Big Sleep, these kinds of stories updated all the way up to today, the Jack Reacher stories, the Die Hard stories. These are all these rugged individualists, these sons and sometimes daughters of the cowboy, right? Who are these radical individualists who can defy convention and do what they want. It's a kind of nostalgia for a world that we once had and has now been lost.
Now this cowboy myth persists, right? It's embedded, I think, still. You mentioned very recent movies, for example.
Yeah, it's a very attractive story. I find it attractive. We all like to do what we want to do, but as environmental and ecological and social constraints become more pressing, this myth becomes more and more dysfunctional. In my own lifetime, the population of the United States has more than doubled. Places that I remember camping in Utah in the 1980s, and you would go to places like Calf Creek down in the Escalante, and it would be empty. And now, empty. Tell me about empty. And of course, when you have more people, this means you're going to have to modify your behavior in order to respect other people's rights. This does come into conflict. This clashes with this kind of fundamental libertarianism of the American spirit.
In fact, I want to read this paragraph from your introduction, and I think we can all relate to this. You said these classic images of the American West, you know, talking about what we've just been talking about, the cowboy myth, the wide open spaces. Reality matches these images if you catch things at the right time, but there are other views that don't make it into the coffee table books. Of $500 a night hotel rooms, campsites that must be reserved 6 months in advance, underpaid and overworked staff, dead animals along highways, long commutes and housing prices that rival New York and San Francisco, a few rhapsodize about walking for a mile in asphalt before getting to the trail you want to hike. That's, in many cases, the new reality.
It is. It's a reality that no wonder we have a nostalgia for the past. I even see a phenomenon like Donald Trump as appealing to this past. He wants to make America great again, which of course assumes that we can recapture a past which I and my our authors, the editors and the authors feel is, alas, gone, and we need to adapt our social and political and economic institutions and our ideologies, our philosophies for a new reality on the ground.
You have another description here that really resonated with me. Because I've been a part of both of these. You say rather than the traditional two-week drive by of national parks with the kids in tow. So when I was a kid, my parents drove us cross-country a couple times, right? We were part of this. Visitors and residents now find multifaceted industry that generates nearly 2% of the American economy, the recreation industry. One of your authors describes this industry as the recreation industry. So there's been a huge shift.
Yeah, the Todd Wilkinson piece. Some of your folks will know Todd Wilkinson. He's published a lot. He was the editor of Mountain Journal. He's now started a new online journal called The Yellowstonian. And the title of his piece, which is based on the GYE, the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem, is Recreation as Recreation, as W-R-E-C-K, right? There was a belief back in the 70s and 80s that if we could shift the economies of the American West from resource exploitation to travel and tourism, that this would be a net win for the environment. This belief too has died hard. We have come to realize that we may be able to restore a forest that's been cut down or a mining district. But when a subdivision goes in Paradise Valley in southern Montana, that subdivision and the displaced wildlife that results from it, that subdivision is there forever. And so this has been something of a shock to folks who think about environmental ethics and policy, that it turns out what we thought was going to be solution has created as many or perhaps even more problems.
So we'll get into some specifics as we move along this hour, but authors in the book explore things such as zoom towns, jammed roads, conservation easements, rewilding beaver, second homes, housing shortages, ranch land management, over tourism. The big theme, I think, is the need for limits, right? There's not unlimited resources, not unlimited space. And so you talk about the cowboy myth, and you say in your introduction, we need a new myth. What would that look like, do you think?
Well, you know, this is such an interesting part of our the volume. I think that when we have a couple ways we tend to think about solving our problems with. We solve them through economic growth, or we solve them through science and technology. And part of our suggestion here is that actually the arts and the humanities have an essential role to play. It is the artists who give us a vision of a life that we come to embrace. Let me give a historical example based in the Grand Canyon. And this is a point that we've taken from the historian of fire, Stephen Pine, a professor at Arizona State. Pine, in a wonderful little book titled How the Canyon Became Grand, notes that in 1860, people thought the Grand Canyon was an abomination, a wasteland, something that no one would ever want to visit. The 1857 expedition, the Ives expedition, in their summary report said, "Doubtless we are the last party to come to this profitless locality." What changed our attitude about this abysmal hole in the ground? Artists, photographers, painters. This is the story that Pine tells, that it was the creation of a new type of beauty. If you live in Europe or the East Coast and the ground is brown, that means something's dead or tore up. And so the colors of the Grand Canyon were thought first to be a kind of an assault upon the eye. And it was only through artists giving us a new aesthetic that we came to revere places like the Grand Canyon or Southern Utah. Part of the thesis of this book is that we need to, we will be dependent upon artists, whether they're painters or writers or videographers. We're going to need the help of new stories, new narratives, new images to make a life where we respect limits attractive. Now, who's going to do this? Good question. It's not going to be folks like me, but we're hoping that we can help prompt folks to think about how to make a world where we have to recognize limits and we care for creation. In new ways, we can make this new vision attractive.
Yeah, you write that Moran's painting, Grand Canyon of the Yellowstone, hangs in Statuary Hall in U.S. Capitol. That's an indication of its, you know, effect.
Yeah, it was Moran, a painter, who led to the creation of the world's first national park, Yellowstone. In 1872. I mean, it's an amazing connection between art and policymaking, right? It's the image that we see which affects people, which moves people emotionally, which gives them a new vision.
So I'm having trouble visualizing this. I guess that's the point, right? This new myth, this new art has yet to be created, right? We've been used to the cowboy movies, used to the art that perpetrated this previous myth. Now this myth of limits. What shape does that take? Do you think?
It's a good question. I'm not an artist. You know, I'm a cultural critic, a cultural historian, and a philosopher. I look back and I see what's happened to this myth of the infinite frontier. Right, the Shane-like character. You'll remember in George Stevens' 1952 movie, Shane. Shane comes out of the mountains, right? Comes out of the Tetons at the beginning, out of the wilderness, and then returns after, you know, righting the wrongs of this little town on the edge of the Tetons, right? And this myth continues to promulgate. Perhaps the most successful series of stories and movies and books of the last 60 years has been the Star Trek mandate, the motif, right? And we all know how that begins. It's space, the final and infinite frontier. And William Shatner is the cowboy racing across different quadrants. Now, how do we make a new way of life attractive, one where we no longer define freedom in terms of doing whatever the heck we want, but now in terms of moderating our desires, being more selective, keeping more of an eye out for the other fellow. I do think you can look back and see hints of a different story in a director like Frank Capra. Frank Capra, across a series of movies in the 1930s, Meet John Doe, for instance, right? He emphasizes the importance of community. And here, individuals come to embrace the needs of the community, and they find meaning in their life by doing so.
Mm. As I think about this, you mentioned Star Trek, you know, the William Shatner's the cowboy, rugged individualist, right? That's part of the cowboy myth. But there's community there as well, right? There's a utopian view where nations and peoples have finally come together, at least on Earth, and to work together.
It's kind of hilarious. It's really fun to think back, especially about the original Star Trek, right? You had the Romulans were the Russians, right? And I forget the name of the other group, which were the Chinese. Right. And they even made them look a little bit Russian or speak a little bit Russian. Yeah, this is such an attractive story. Even if you look back to John Kennedy's speeches of the early 1960s, he embraced this frontier myth too, right? It was the frontier society that what he was inaugurating as he broke from the stabilities of the Eisenhower administration.
So you write that the West has always been the nation's escape valve, an individual's escape valve too. You could go to the West, right? You could reinvent yourself, and I guess people still do that, but maybe fewer and fewer opportunities as we fill up these spaces.
Yeah, it's funny the role of technology plays in this. You could reinvent yourself in an age without social security cards, much less computers and databases and whatnot. You could drop your name and take on a new identity, move to Wyoming or Utah or someplace. Again, those days are gone as we have created this kind of what? This internet saturated culture where almost all information is instantly accessible. This is another theme here where we, in the book, across several of the essays, there's a suspicion of the role that technology is playing. We have had this assumption that technology will free us, but there's at least an argument to be made that technology now increasingly is used to control us. Something I'm struck by is that it used to be when you wanted to call one of these mega companies, your phones company or your internet service company or whatever else, they would use the phone tree, press one for this and press two for that, as a way to more efficiently serve you. But I bet you've noticed that these days, almost all companies use this phone tree, automated phone tree, as a way to put you off, as a way to control you and to keep you from communicating with them. And so, again, part of the story here is the motifs, the assumptions of the last 300 years, such as there's infinite space, there's infinite resources, and science and technology. If there are any kind of limits we bump into, we can overcome them through science and technology. This book wants to introduce a note of caution or even suspicion that all these things are really our friends, and to call upon the arts and humanities to think about how they can have a revitalized role in our culture.
Well, let's take a break. We'll come back much more to talk about. We're talking about a new book, a collection of essays called A Watershed Moment, The American West in the Age of Limits. And we're talking with one of the editors, Robert Frohterman. I'll mention a couple of events Robert Frohterman will be to, as well as other editors of the book and other panelists. So Thursday, November 21st at 12:15 in the afternoon at University of Utah's Law School, the Stegner Center, Wallace Stegner Center there, is hosting a green bag event to be a panel discussion about the book, and everyone is invited. That'll also be a virtual event. You can register for that. Then the next day, Friday, November 22nd at 5:30 p.m., running till 7:30 at Westminster University in Salt Lake City. There will be a night of conversation, canapes, cocktails, panel discussion, art and music. And Robert Frohterman will be there as well, along with others. So that's November 21st and 22nd, a couple of events, University of Utah and Westminster University. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Robert Frohterman, one of the editors of a new book, A Watershed Moment, The American West in the Age of Limits. And Robert Frohterman is a retired professor of philosophy. He writes on environmental philosophy and public policy, the philosophy of science and technology, and the future of the university. He's the author, editor of 16 books. He'll be at a couple of events relating to A Watershed Moment. University of Utah on November 21st and Westminster University on November 22nd. We'll have details on our website, upr.org, just in an hour or two here following this conversation. So Robert Frodeman, you were talking about technology before the break and how this volume encourages us to be a little bit skeptical. A lot of times we feel like, well, technology will solve all of our problems, right? Maybe, maybe not, right? But one area where technology is shifting, literally shifting people around, Zoom towns. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that. For example, have a friend in Bozeman, Montana. He said that during COVID that it had a real boom there, people moving in because they could work from anywhere.
Yeah, Bozeman is a great example of this, and so is the town just to my north. I live 10 miles outside of Jackson, Wyoming. Bozeman and Jackson, along with Telluride, Colorado, and also a chapter on Morgan County, Utah, close to you folks. All of these chapters wrestle with different aspects of the housing issue. Jackson, for instance, Jackson is in Teton County that it sits within, 25,000 people in Teton County, is the most expensive housing market in the United States. It's, if you look at the across the 3,400 counties in the United States, the second per capita, the second richest county is New York City, Manhattan. The first is Teton County. And what we have seen across the 2010s in Jackson has been, and then accelerated by COVID, has been the growth of a Zoom economy where people both nationally and internationally have moved to Jackson because they can. I know I have a colleague here in town who gets up at 4 o'clock in the morning because he works in Frankfurt, Germany. And so he has to get on Frankfurt time. Now, what's interesting, you began this question with Bozeman. What's interesting is how the land itself shapes these conversations in different ways. Bozeman, compared to Jackson, radically different geographies. Bozeman sits in the Gallatin Valley, and they can sprawl for miles and miles outside of Bozeman. Jackson, on the other hand, is rimmed by mountains in every direction. You have to come across one of three mountain passes to get into Jackson. And Jackson, already 97% of the land of Teton County is public land, either a wildlife refuge, the elk refuge, or the national parks, or the national forests. And so the geography of the West shifts the way these communities have to address the challenges that they face.
So land very scarce, and that leads to cascading a series of, I guess, problems, right? So more people move in. Housing becomes just prohibitively expensive, for one thing.
In Jackson, in Teton County, the median price for a home is $6.5 million.
Wow.
And I live on the poorest street on the outskirts of Teton County next to Lincoln County. We bought a place here in 2013 for $300,000, and it's now worth nearly $2 million. So I'm, you know, house rich, though not rich. My descendants will probably do pretty good. And these kind of phenomena are common across the West. You can tell similar stories in Telluride, for instance, or in Park City.
Then you have traffic, right? I think we've all been in these towns. You know, Zion National Park is one example. They have to go to a shuttle bus, right? But for example, they're in Jackson, they're... I guess the Wyoming Department of Transportation is going to build more roads, but then you have the problem of, you know, Field of Dreams. You build it, more will come.
Yeah, this is there's a couple chapters that wrestle with this point. One of the co-editors of this volume, Luther Probst, is a Teton County commissioner, and he's wrestling with these questions in a quite practical way. His chapter on Jackson is not really so much about Jackson, but rather about this weird triangular affair that we have, where people drive in from the south, what's called Star Valley, that's 40 miles south of Jackson, or from the west in Teton Valley, Idaho, which is another 35 miles. In one case, you have to drive through the Snake River Canyon, which is where some of your readers, some of your listeners will know that the Grizzly 399 died a couple weeks ago. Or you have to drive across Teton Pass, which is a real challenge on days like today when we got 3, 4 inches of snow. These are gnarly conditions. But what we have here is that we have the service economy folks, the carpenters, the people who work in hotels or in retail, they drive in from 30 and 40 miles away from the south and from the west to serve this super town of the either the legacy homeowners, right, who are passing away or selling out in many cases, or the super rich. And so it creates a very strange, both an economic dilemma in terms of tax structures, but also a very strange cultural dimension as people empty out. In the evening, they pass by my home here in Hoback every evening, and there is a constant stream of pickup trucks, you know, as the carpenters and the plumbers and electricians go back down to Star Valley for the night.
And we see this all over the West, right? I have a friend of a friend, kind of acquaintance of an acquaintance. I think he's a highway patrol trooper, stationed in Park City, at least he was. So you can't live in Park City, too expensive. People who work in Park City used to live in Heber City, another 40 miles away. Now that's becoming too expensive. So he's another 30 minutes away in Duchesne, small town of Duchesne. I guess that's an example of, and this is happening all over.
Yeah, it's striking. And I should note that this book of the 25 chapters, we have 5 chapters on the state of Utah. We have a chapter by Bonnie Baxter on the Great Salt Lake. She teaches in Salt Lake, and she'll be well known to some of your listeners. We also have a chapter by Sean Hill on which is on Morgan County, Utah, and the pressures that mega developments are putting upon people who have been living in Morgan County, a rural area to the east and north of Salt Lake. We also have a chapter on drought and Glen Canyon and the new side canyons that are being revealed by by the drought. This is by a scientist named Seth Ahrens. A chapter on Bears Ear National Monument. This was written by a Native American, a Ute, named Regina White Skunk. And finally, we have a chapter on the Navajo Reservation and the housing challenges they have there. I might also mention that Jennifer Wesselhoff, who wrote our chapter on over-tourism in Sedona, where she used to be the head of the Chamber of Commerce, now lives in Park City and is the CEO of the Chamber of Commerce in Park City, where again, she's trying to alleviate the difficulties of over-tourism and the transportation and the housing issues that result from this.
I want to pause right there. So, the chapter in Sedona is very interesting. I think some progress being made. Tell me a little bit about what's being done in some of these towns like Sedona to address over-tourism.
I'd send you to the chapters for the details, but this is a matter of trying to control short-term rentals, right? Which again, another result of technology, right? The invention of things like Airbnb, website like this, and the fact that people could suddenly rent out their homes, or their second homes, right, as vacation rentals and make enormous amounts of money. This started out as rather benign, then has turned in places like Sedona, has turned into a monster in two stages. First, people started buying homes simply to rent out to people that might drive up, in Sedona's case, from Phoenix for a weekend. There would be behavioral problems. You no longer had a tight-knit community because you had a series of short-termers, short-termers. And then more recently, there are corporations coming into places like Park City and Sedona and buying up these houses to create a new kind of corporation of short-term housing. Now, the problems here are legion. Places like Sedona and Jackson have addressed this in a variety of ways. For instance, in Jackson, there are only five areas. I say Jackson, I mean Teton County. There are only five areas where you can rent for less than 30 days, right? And so this involved the city council or the county commissioners in these areas innovating in terms of public policy and land development regulations and things like this to control this kind of what new phenomenon, which was given to us by technology. We talked about Zoom towns briefly a little while ago. Again, here's a new technology which allows people to work remotely from all over the world. Heck, you and I are talking via Zoom right now, right? But this has dumped a new set of problems upon these attractive communities, Telluride or Santa Fe or whatnot. And local officials are wrestling for how to come up with innovations to control these new technological results.
Let's take another break. Come back with the final segment with Robert Frohterman. The book is A Watershed Moment, The American West in the Age of Limits. And there'll be a couple of events in Utah featuring Robert Frohterman and others. The first of those is on Thursday, November 21st, 12:15 in the afternoon at the Wallace Stegner Center. They're presenting this. This will be at the University of Utah's Law School. It's in person and virtual. You can register for that. We'll have a link to that on our website, upr.org, a little bit later. So that's on Thursday, November 21st, 12:15. Then the next day, Friday, November 22nd, starting at 5:30 p.m., there's an event at Westminster University, also featuring Robert Frohterman and others. That'll have music and food and arts and everything. So Thursday, November 21st, University of Utah, Friday, November 22nd, Westminster University, and we'll have details at upr.org. More following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We have a few minutes left with Robert Frohterman. He's one of the editors of a new book, A Watershed Moment, The American West in the Age of Limits. So you were mentioning some specific examples from the book. We'll urge you to go read the book. It's out from University of Utah Press. Areas, chapters organized into areas such as resource use and overuse, equitable communities, preserving private and public lands, coexisting with wildlife and wildfire, and restoring nature. A lot of solutions in the book as well. I want to go back out to 30,000 feet, though, here at the end, Robert Frohterman. You write that we will need to change our values, and that's a hard thing. You say it's difficult to make self-restraint attractive. So that's going to need to be the new myth, right? And that you said earlier, stories, artists can help us with this. I wonder, are there any examples in the book that you could point to where maybe we're moving in this direction?
Well, we were just talking about housing issues and short-term rentals and over-tourism. And also I can note the work that's going on in national parks. We talk about authors talk about Grand Teton and Yellowstone among other national parks. And part of what we're trying to, and I don't mean here the authors in the book, but our culture in general, is we're trying to encourage a new ethic, a new attitude when we go to places like Yellowstone, where people understand the value of limiting their own behavior and respecting both nature and the other visitors to these locations. You could frame this as a kind of question of cultural maturity. I remember reading a book a few years ago, the subtitle of which was "Aging Boys Will Be the Death of Us." This kind of attitude of a 14-year-old boy that let's give it a whirl. What could go wrong, right? Rather than understanding that, and this is something that all of us realize as we get older, we need to control our desires, our passions, our appetites. Otherwise, bad things happen, heart attacks, you don't control your weight if you don't exercise. And we learn over time that these restrictions, which were at first onerous, are truly life enhancing. And so that's part of what I suggest we need to promote is a sense that willfulness, a kind of willful individualism, even a kind of don't tread on me attitude, is ultimately destructive to the individual, him and herself.
I wonder, well, I guess, first of all, a couple of questions here at the end. We just have a couple of minutes. What do you most hope that people take from this book? We'd urge people to pick it up, read it. What do you hope people take from it?
Well, let us end by noting some of the things we haven't talked about. We have chapters on the borderlands, that is, both El Paso, the U.S.-Mexico border, and also up in Glacier National Park, the U.S.-Canadian border. And so there's this element that the Internet Mountain West expands north and south into these other areas, in terms of indigenous rights and water quality issues, respectively, in these two areas. We also have three chapters on the growing movement of indigenous rights. A chapter on the Navajo Reservation, on the Blackfoot Reservation up in Montana, and then in Utah, Bears Ears. And this is there's a growing recognition on largely in the part of the Biden administration and Holland's appointment as the first Native American as director of the Secretary of the Department of Interior. This is an important shift in our culture in recognizing human rights that the book tries to emphasize. And finally, we should talk about the fact that this book, it's in terms of changing our values. We mean not only our ethical values, but also in terms of how we use knowledge. And so this book, yes, this book has academics writing chapters, but we also have journalists and people involved in policy making and agency scientists at various agencies across the West. The problem with academia, as I learned over my career, is that it produces all this wonderful stuff, but doesn't think enough about how to turn this information into usable policy making for communities. And so every chapter ends with a policy focus of how we can take the analysis, the prior analysis, to turn toward effective problem solving.
Yeah, that is hopeful. We'll leave it there, out of time. We've been talking with Robert Froderman, one of the editors of the new book, out and available, Watershed, A Watershed Moment, The American West in the Age of Limits. Let me mention here at the end a couple of events. Robert Froderman and others will be to these events. The Wallace Stegner Center is presenting a Greed Bag event. That's on Thursday, November 21st, 12:15 p.m. is when that starts. That's at the University of Utah Law School. Then the next day, Friday, November 22nd, 5:30 to 7:30, an event at Westminster University. We'll have details on this, links to details on our website, upr.org, here in about an hour. Robert Froderman, thank you so much for the conversation.
This has been a pleasure. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. We'll go out as we do on Tuesdays with our presentation from Utah Humanities and Crossroads. I blocked on that. Crossroads is what we'll go to. And thanks, everyone, for listening.
Every rural person and place has a story. Change is part of that story. Rural Utah at a Crossroads is part of the Smithsonian Traveling Exhibit Crossroads, Change in Rural America, which explores the changing meaning of rural life and identity. Utah Humanities is touring Crossroads to 8 rural communities across Utah in 2024. As part of the tour, Utah Humanities and Utah Public Radio are partnering with exhibition hosts to interview local residents about change in their communities. This interview was recorded at the Wasatch County Library in Heber City, Utah.
My name is Catherine Berg, and I was born and raised in Heber. All my life, I've lived in rural Utah. I started teaching at Richfield High School, and I was the physical education teacher, and I taught there for 2 years. And then I moved to Orem Alpine School District. I loved that district. I taught at Orem Junior High for 7 years, and then I went to Cedar City and became associated with Southern Utah University, and I was there for 33 years. And there, I was a coach. I coached everything because that's when everything started for women. And then from the beginning, I was over women's athletics. And later on, I became the associate director of athletics over all sports, except I never was over men's basketball. It was hard for the football coaches to have me kind of in charge and directing them occasionally. But I had great opportunities. The last sport that I coached was women's gymnastics, but I had the opportunity to coach basically everything in the women's program. There weren't very many, I don't even know what the right word, concessions made for women to do anything. And in the beginning, the kids paid their way. We had one set of uniform for team sports. We had one set of warm-ups. We practiced in the beginning. I was the coach. I taught a full day. We'd start practicing one sport at 6 o'clock in the morning because there was usually two going a season. Then we'd begin our second practice after open recreation, which meant mainly men, at 9 o'clock at night. So my days were pretty long. Changing minds is tough. Money is slim. Splitting money up so all can have the opportunity was really, really hard. But it happened, and it's better, but not complete yet. And it won't be in my lifetime, I'm sure. But it's about 900% better. It's just as meaningful and as important for them as it is for the young boys. Absolutely is. Gives them opportunities to develop skills, to develop social skills, to develop leadership skills, to develop skills that will help them in their careers. I have had the opportunity, not so much in Richfield, I was just 21, but everywhere else I have taught, I've had the opportunity to work in city or county government as on a committee or being actively engaged in something. So to be able to participate and to see change and to have a say on even a limited basis on how some of that change was coming about has been a great thing, and I'm grateful for that. I'm really an optimistic person, thinking that things will come along and things will change. Things will be good because this is such a beautiful place. People here are beautiful. We've had a surge of people moving in, and a lot of times people moving in bring things with them, both good and not so good. And that brings enrichment. So we don't want to lose that, but we want to maintain who we are. I hope we continue to grow in love and congeniality and services that will bless and strengthen people and be a place for people who want to come to recreate, because it is a recreation tourist place now, but that we do those things with just with, I don't know whether you call it panache or what, but just do it well. I really hope that.
Rural Utah at a Crossroads is produced by Maya Shumway. It is a collaboration between Utah Public Radio, Utah Humanities, and the community hosts of Crossroads, Change in Rural America, a Smithsonian Museum on Main Street exhibition made possible in the Beehive State by Utah Humanities. Support for Museum on Main Street has been provided by the United States Congress. Broadcasts of Rural Utah at a Crossroads on UPR is supported by our members,